Mike Emmerich joins us on Sports Byline. He has been inducted into the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame, and deservedly so. You know, I've watched hockey, and I have such respect for the hockey announcers, and Mike is the best in the business. You can see him, of course, doing NHL hockey telecasts on NBC versus, and he's done them for every network you could imagine. I don't think there's a network you have missed, is there, Mike?
Can't hold a job, Ron. What happens, you just can't hold a job. But, no, I don't think I've missed many of them, but, you know, a lot of just the raw number of years would dictate that because the rights have changed a number of times.
Let me ask you about going into the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame. When I talk to athletes about what it means to them, I usually get a standard answer from them. But I've never ever had the chance to ask somebody who has gone into a broadcasting Hall of Fame or even the Hockey Hall of Fame from a broadcaster's perspective. Tell me what it means to you, Mike.
Well, I grew up near Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I watched a lot of minor league pro hockey, and occasionally I watched the colleges, and then at the Olympics I watched the U.S. teams. And I think just the raw number of people that have played the sport or managed it or coached it or been general managers and organized teams like Lou Lamoriello did in the World Cup that the U.S. won in 1996. And I think about all of those people and to be picked from all of those people as one of five and one of, I don't know, a couple hundred, over 100 years of the United States being involved in hockey is awesome. It's an incredible honor. You don't think you deserve it because you look at all of the people that have been involved in the sport, but it is awesome when you get the phone call and someone tells you that you're going to join that select group.
What was it about hockey that you gravitated doing play-by-play for that sport rather than maybe one of the other sports?
I really wanted to do baseball, Ron. When I was growing up, my brother and I played baseball in the front yard every day, and we actually drove nails into plywood pieces and built our own Wrigley Field-style scoreboard. And we would sit in the room when we weren't playing. We'd listen to games on the radio and hang the scores up inning by inning like they still do at Wrigley Field. We were fanatics on baseball, and we still enjoy it. But once my parents, after I badgered them enough, I guess, took me to a hockey game in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It was an International League game between Fort Wayne and the Muskegon Zephyrs in the old IHL. And at that point, I was hooked, and being a baseball broadcaster never interested me again. I in my life, have only done one game, and I had to be reminded that I did. It was in college at Miami of Ohio against Kent State, and I also had to be reminded that Thurman Munson played in the game and Steve Stone was available to pitch but did not. That's how long ago it was.
Mike, one of the things that I know about successful announcers in various sports is that they have an instinct, they have a feel, they have a sense of the game, and you certainly do have that. How long did it take you to develop that?
I don't know if there was a turning point in that, Ron. I think it's the great educator Suzuki said that all skill is knowledge plus doing something 10,000 times. Well, I haven't done 10,000 games, that's for sure. But at some point, I think you wind up through just the number of games, if you study what you do and try to make it better, that you're gradually going to get to the point where it becomes a lot easier for you to do, and that there's not a panic that sets in as you approach a big game as much. You still have that nervousness that I always liked Wayne Gretzky's story of being in the room with a rookie at Madison Square Garden when he was a Ranger near the end of his career, and the kid was pacing back and forth. He was playing his first NHL game, and Gretzky said, "Are you nervous?" And he said, "I sure am." And Wayne said, "I am too. It's that way every game." We all have a little bit of that, but I think the panic part of it, you get over as just from the raw number of games that you do. And I feel blessed to get in free to see a lot of hockey.
One of the things that I think is interesting, and you made this comment to me before we went on the air, is that hockey is nonstop action, and you're absolutely right about that. So that would mean that the hockey announcer has to develop a rhythm, does he not, as far as the flow of the game, so that he's in the same rhythm as the flow of the game?
No, you're right, Ron. I think that's true. And I think even in baseball and some of the sports that you think would be, you know, stop and then action and then stop and then action, I think there's still a rhythm of anticipation that the guys that do baseball and football have for that, too. But Bob Chase, who was my icon growing up, and he still does the Fort Wayne Comets games, he'll be 86 in January, and he will be in his 58th season of doing the game. That first game I went to, he broadcast, and he's still doing the games. But anyway, when I was a college kid, I held a microphone in front of him and asked him a lot of questions and pretended it was a term paper I had to do. That was my excuse to get to visit with him. And I asked him that. I said, what about hockey being a hard sport? And all I was doing was parroting his answer. You don't have a lot of stoppages in hockey. It's virtually nonstop action. And he thought for that reason, and I agree, it's easier than the other sports are, because that one attempt that I had at baseball, I realized how much you had to have in your brain to fill in that time between pitches. It's a lot.
Let me ask you about anticipation. That's a word that you used, and I certainly am aware of it with the play-by-play assignments that I've had, and I was involved with a game that I kind of anticipated a little bit that something was going to happen unusual, and it was the Stanford-Cal football game. I was doing
great!
I was doing the Stanford broadcast in that game, and I just knew that something was going to happen. Tell me a little bit about you. Do you anticipate anything, especially in big games, that something might happen? How do you handle anticipation, Mike?
I think Bill Clement, when he and I were working together on ESPN and with the Flyers, we used to tell each other. He came up with the concept, and he said, expect the unexpected. Don't bring the game in your briefcase. Enjoy it. And those were the three things that we always tried to do. And I remember repeating, expect the unexpected. I saw Bill the morning of Game 6 between Chicago and Philadelphia. That ended in the most unexpected way that handcuffed all of us that were trying to do play-by-play of it that night. We didn't have a band on the end line near the Chicago goal that night, but we had just about as much chaos. When it's a Stanley Cup winning goal, you like to be on it. And we asked up and down the line, and we were all sort of lost there because we lost sight of the puck. And then we started watching the players' heads. That's what you do when you can't see the puck. A lot of times it's screened out by the near boards. You just watch the players' heads, and they're usually all looking at it. Well, the players' heads were going in every direction because they couldn't find it either. So for that reason, we were all a bit lost on it. So I expected the unexpected that night, but I had no idea it was going to be that chaotic. You try to anticipate some things happening, but because the game's spontaneous, you never can be for sure.
Given the speed of hockey, how hard is it to get the right player with the puck at the right time?
I think in some of the arenas that we have now, and also with some of the arena designs of the jersey designs, Ron, it's harder than others. For example, a New Jersey jersey red against white, a Detroit jersey red against white, is easier than a New York Rangers jersey, which is blue, with red and blue and white together on the sleeve. That buffers the starkness of the number, and it makes it harder to identify. You may have had that in football. I remember one of the historic games in the early years of television of football was the day that Army played Navy, and Army came out with white uniforms and gold numbers, and the field in Philadelphia was wet, and the numbers were obliterated, and you had no way of knowing who the Army players were if you were the play-by-play guy. I was just a grade school guy watching it on television, but it made quite an impression on me that, you know, you're really handcuffed if you can't identify players. In a lot of the arenas in Canada, the press box where we work is very close to the ice. It's high, and it follows the Foster Hewitt mandate as to how close to the ice you need to be and how high. In some of the U.S. rinks, they have a tendency to copy one another, and we tend to be way up and way back, which makes it more of a challenge. It is hard, but as Patrick Waugh said when he let in a bad goal once, I'm paid to get those. So there's no excuse. Sometimes you get them and sometimes you don't, and you hope that there are more times you do than you don't.
Mike Emmerich is with us, and you see him, of course, and hear him as the lead announcer on the NHL telecasts of both NBC and Versus, and now a member of the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame. Mike, all of us who have been around sports for a long period of time have seen great players. When I was doing the Stanford games, John Elway was the quarterback down there. Darren Nelson was the running back. We've all seen great players in our broadcasting careers. What is it that you find is the commonality of the great players in the sport of hockey?
I think the thing that we find, even with players that may not have grown up in North America, is that I think in 38 years, I can count maybe 7 or 8 jerks that I will never mention that I've met in hockey. The rest of the players are all, maybe you can say that it's the fact that the sport was in Canada, it's unspoiled, the guys sacrificed and so did their parents to enable them to play the sport at an early age, and so they're they're more unsullied by the fact that they do make millions of dollars, but they don't act like it. And for that reason, I think the one common thing that I notice is humility. I realize that it's a spontaneous game, it's slippery, it's played on ice, and as a result, you wind up being embarrassed by things that happen when you're out there. But I think the humility is the common thing, and I just heard it talked about on one of the talk shows here in Detroit today about the hockey guys and what good guys they are for media folks to deal with. And they're also wise enough to know that we in the media are the conduit between them and the fans. And that's the one thing that they grasp. Maybe some other guys don't. But I think, by and large, the hockey players get that.
Yeah, they're blue-collar players, blue-collar athletes. I agree with you. The one thing I respect of you more than anything else, and especially the people in hockey, is your ability to pronounce very difficult names. Certainly with the influx of European players, that has become even more of a challenge. You are the founding member and still president of the NHL Pronunciation Guide, which is used as a guide for all NHL broadcasters for some of hockey's most difficult names. Tell me, how hard is that? To take something which is a different language or meant in a different way, saying a name, how difficult is it to pronounce all those names?
It's a challenge, but by the same token, usually when a player tells you how he wants his name said, he doesn't change it. Now, there are exceptions. Teemu Selänne came over here from Finland and after 1 year was convinced by the Winnipeg Jets to change his pronunciation to Selänne, and the reason was that everybody was saying it that way. Well, it doesn't make it right, and his family, I'm sure his parents, still pronounce it that way. But it is a challenge as long as the player doesn't change it. We always like to ask the player how they'd like it said, and as long as it's not terribly affected, we may anglicize it a little bit. As long as it's not terribly affected, that's how we do it. For example, an exception to that were the Stachny brothers from Slovakia that were a part of the NHL with the Quebec Nordiques. And if you start, and I tried to do it, I tried to say it the right way, but it became very affected because they passed it between the three of them, especially on the power play fast, and it became much easier and probably drew less attention to itself to say Stachny rather than Stachny.
We only have about 90 seconds left.
Sort of fractured, isn't it?
Exactly. We have about 90 seconds left, and I know you've had a lot of great memorable moments. You've seen a lot of great moments, but can you share some of your personal favorites with us, Mike?
Well, some of them that stand out are the more recent ones. I think Zach Parise scoring in the last half minute with a goal he pulled against Canada, and then all of those brilliant saves that were made by Ryan Miller in overtime, and then Crosby's goal, which beat him. I think that's a game that will stay in my mind for a long time. For another reason, I think Chicago's run to the championship, Tim Thomas's goaltending, and we talk about the humility of hockey players. There's the living embodiment of it. His parents hocked their rings so that he could get more hockey equipment. He sold apples door to door in a 5,000 population town in rural Michigan so that he could further his hockey career. And I think, you know, those are a part of things that will stay in my memory. They are among the more recent ones. Edmonton's 1987 run to the 7-game Stanley Cup victory over Philly stays with me because that's one of the finest teams I've seen in my life. I think the 92 unified team that was the last one that really came out of the old Soviet Union that had been developed there, and the 87 Oilers are the two best teams I've ever seen. The Oilers had six of the greatest players in the world. All of them are in the Hall of Fame now. And they rolled through most seasons, but Philadelphia and Ron Hextall challenged them all the way to the 7th game before they eventually buckled and Edmonton won.
In about 20 seconds, one of the games that jump out at me is the April 18th, 1999 game, Pens against Rangers and Gretzky's final game.
Yeah, it does, we're following him all day, and I think the thing that stuck out was not the game itself, but the joy and the celebration and the love that he and the fans in New York had for him. The Rangers missed the playoffs, but I stood outside Madison Square Garden when it was all over, and I watched the fans coming out, and they're critical fans, but every one of them had a smile on their face that day.
Thank you very much, and congratulations, Mike. Well-deserved. I appreciate you spending some time with us on Sports Byline.
Next time, I want to hear your call of the end of that game.
You got it. Mike Emmerich with us, inducted into the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame. We continue with more of you and Sports Byline.